from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this Forum Hour. Richard Muller is professor of physics at UC Berkeley and the author of the bestseller Physics for Future Presidents. He was a MacArthur Genius Award recipient for his work in experimental cosmology, and he shared the Breakthrough Prize in Fundamental Physics for the discovery of dark energy. His new book is called Now, The Physics of Time, and he joins us here in the KQED studio for this Forum Hour. And Rich Mueller, good to have you back with us. Welcome.
Delightful to be back.
Well, this is a book that fascinated me, and I really want to get into it in so many ways, physics, cosmological, and so forth. But what you really did was figure out a jigsaw puzzle here. I mean, you really got into the whole question of what is now and how we define now, and it takes us to time again and to understanding time, which right away stretches and flows and sort of moves all over the place, doesn't it?
Time is very peculiar. I've been fascinated with it ever since I was a kid. I thought I would learn about it in physics when I became a physics major. I learned a lot about it. We know a lot about time. It has some very weird, mysterious properties. But in the end, the answer wasn't there. This has bothered me my whole career. I've talked about this every time I teach a class. I talk about the mystery of now. What does that mean? Why isn't it discussed in physics? Physics usually doesn't tell you about the things it doesn't cover. And that is one of them. The flow of time is more or less absent from the current level of physics understanding. That's amazing.
Well, it's expanding, too, as you point out. I mean, new time is the now, right?
I think of new time as a continual creation of new nows. The word I said, that word that was spelled N-O-W that I said about 20 seconds ago, no longer represents what is now. It's ephemeral. It keeps on changing. What's going on here? It almost seems like a Calvin and Hobbes cartoon.
Well, I always think of T.S. Eliot, the now that is always now. You know, he's talking about almost a kind of transcendent now.
And each one is different.
Each one is completely different than the one before, yeah.
There are several aspects to this. I mean, Einstein made enormous progress in understanding time. The famous twin paradox, that different twins can experience different amounts of time, that is mind-boggling and yet solidly established. I've done the experiment myself in my laboratory. So there are things we do understand that are not part of the general public, and that's really where I try to start in my book, to bring the readers up to date with what is solidly established. A lot of it is astonishing.
Well, you also take us back to the Big Bang. I mean, that plays a central role in terms of time and the now.
I think it does, although that's a new contribution. When I started writing this book, it was going to be a book about the mystery of now, about what it is we don't understand, what are these strange things, why other people who have written on the subject, such as Eddington, why I'm convinced that these things were wrong, why the only person who got everything right was Einstein. But where do it was going to be a book about the mystery.
He didn't even know what now was, really, did he?
Einstein did not. And he wrote about, he's quoted as saying that he regards this as a mystery unsolved, and he feared that the answer would lie outside of physics. He wanted physics to be complete. He wanted to be able to explain everything. And this seemed to be outside the realm of physics.
And physics, you say in your book, is incomplete with respect to reality. You raise the whole question, what does the color blue look like? And I want to get to that. But I want to get first to the whole idea of Eddington's arrow of time, which you just alluded to, because you're really kind of taking that and turning it on its head.
Well, back in 1928, the great, no question that he was a great physicist, a theorist, an experimenter, very unusual, Arthur Eddington, wrote a paper, turned it into a book, in which he said the reason that time moves forward and not backward, think about that. What a crazy question to even ask. But the great advances are sometimes made by people asking the right questions. He asked the question, why does time move forward rather than backward? He found the answer in a physics concept called entropy, which we talk about as confusion. The world is getting more confused as things become more
disordered.
Random.
Yeah.
Disordered.
Yeah.
And that's what causes time to move forward. That was it. That was his statement. I wouldn't call it a theory because he never explained any way one could test it to see if it's right or wrong.
But this is the arrow of time.
It's the arrow of time. There have been many books on the arrow of time.
There's also a book by Martin Amis, a novel that based called The Arrow of Time.
Stephen Hawking, in his Brief History of Time, basically accepts Eddington's theory as self-evident.
But it's just the opposite from your perspective of what he argues with respect to entropy, right?
This has bothered me for decades, ever since I became a physicist. It seemed to me Eddington was clearly wrong. It's the motion of time that causes the confusion. Time is the driver, and entropy is the result.
And you say that the control of entropy's pathway is crucial to our understanding of now, and what that ties in with for you is free will.
Yeah, there are two fundamental aspects to the now. One of them is, what is it? What does it consist of? Why is it coming about? What's going on here? That's the physics question. The other question, which I tie into at the end of the book, because this has also intrigued me throughout my whole life, is the meaning of now to us as people, as a person. Why is now such an important moment? We exist in the past. We exist now. Do we exist in the future? Some people say yes. Some people disagree. But now is a very important moment for all of us, for our consciousness. And so near the end of the book, I address why that's the case. The brief answer is, now is the only moment when we can exercise free will.
And when you say that current time is flowing faster than past time, how do you determine that and how do you come to a conclusion of that?
Well, most people would say that's impossible. But thanks to astronomy, we can look back in time. When we look at the sun, we're looking at the way it was 8 minutes ago, not the way it is now. So if
people are hearing this on delay, in fact, this radio broadcast.
That's right. Thousandths of a second, but you're hearing it delayed. So we can look at the rate of time in the past and determine whether it has changed or not, just because it takes time for a signal to move from one place to another.
We're talking with Richard Muller, and his new book is called The Physics of Time. But I want to get back to that question you posed here. What does the color blue look like?
Well, this bothered me when I was a kid. I asked my teacher.
You're wearing a blue shirt, by the way. So am I.
Do you see the same thing I'm seeing?
Probably not.
Does it look like red to you? This is a question that I've asked many people, and I get two kinds of answers. One answer is, that's a nonsensical question. It goes to the same part of the brain. Therefore, we see it the same way. But there's a wonderful, wonderful story by a philosopher named Carnap, who had the concept of Mary, a brilliant scientist who was raised in a colorless environment. She knows all the physics. She knows the physics of rainbows. She sees the beauty in the equations, but she's never been exposed to anything other than black, white, and gray. And then one day she opens the door and goes outside and she sees a rainbow. She sees the sky. She sees the green. The question Carnap asked was, did she learn anything when she did that? Or does she simply say, ah, yes, the rainbow looks exactly like what I expected from my physics equations? I think the answer is she learned what red looks like. Other people say, no, she learned nothing. This is something I can't resolve. I can't convince somebody who doesn't understand what I'm getting at. But to me, it's a very deep question.
Well, there are a lot of deep questions that you deal with in this new book of yours, The Physics of Time. Go back to the Big Bang, for example, because most people sort of think of it in terms of it happened, and you know, but it's ongoing creating of both time and space, right?
The universe is expanding, and most people misunderstand what that means. They think of it as a lump of mass that's flying apart in an otherwise static space. But that's not the way any physicists think about it. It's not the way cosmologists think about it. It goes way back to Einstein and to the early developers of cosmology, we think of the expansion of space as being an expansion of just that, space. The galaxies in this model are all stationary, but the space between them is expanding.
But you talk about four-dimensional time-space. You keep referring to essentially what we're living in as four-dimensional time-space.
That was introduced soon after Einstein, the concept that space and time are intertwined in such a fundamental way has led us to think of reality as existing in space-time. But something about that picture always bothered me. You can stand still in space. Pick any reference frame you want for the physicist listening in. You pick a reference frame, and you can stand still in space. Everybody understands what that means. But you can't stand still in time. Time may be the fourth dimension of space-time, but it behaves in a peculiar and different way. What is going on here? That was the mystery that drove me to look into this subject, to try to resolve it, and to write the book.
So when people, for example, say, I want to be in the present, I want to experience the now, the moment of the now, and so forth, I mean, it's experiencing something that has to do with human consciousness. That's ultimately the experience, isn't it?
Yeah, I think this is related to human consciousness. I prefer to using the word the human spiritual reality. When people say they want to be in the now, what they're really saying is they want to stop worrying so much about the past. Indeed, the past is something we need to study. We need to know about the past so that we don't make the same mistakes over again. At the same time, if you dwell too much on the past, you can't change the past.
Oh, you've done a lot of work. In fact, received many laurels for work in dark energy. And this is something that... It's always been difficult for me to understand. It's like quantum physics. You know, they used to say you have to be either a genius or a maniac to truly understand quantum physics. But I find certainly dark energy is something. How does that figure into expansion of the universe that's continual?
Well, what the dark
or into time?
What the dark energy really is the discovery made by my student Saul Perlmutter and some others that the universe, the expansion, the creation of new space, is accelerating. That's really all it is.
I didn't know Saul was your student. He was a Nobel Prize recipient.
Yeah. He actually was a project that I had initiated and then handed over to him, and he finished it off and did an unbelievable job, did things I don't think I ever could have done, and then was awarded the Nobel Prize for that. But beyond the Nobel Prize, this is one of the most fantastic discoveries of all time, that the universe, the expansion of the universe, the creation of new space is accelerating. Now, don't be confused by the fact that this is called dark energy. We don't know what is doing this. It turns out you can call it dark energy and then stick it into Einstein's equations and you get the acceleration. But all we observe is acceleration, and we don't know what that is. Sometimes there are many possible thoughts. Sometimes I think that space simply repels itself. And so it's accelerating for that reason. It's such a simple concept that it may be right. It's not a physics theory because I'm not telling you how I can test it. And that's the problem. A dark energy is a fancy name for the fact that the universe is speeding up, a phenomenon that was discovered experimentally. In fact, when I began the experiment, I called it the Omega Project, which symbolized the fact that we thought the universe would be slowing down. And I wanted to measure how much it was slowing down. And then Saul took over. And he found it was accelerating. It was an incredible, impossible idea. Saul is such a great physicist, and he had helped put together this enormously great team that even though it was nonsense, he had to publish it. Now, it turns out it's right, but it was unexpected, completely unexpected.
When we talk about the universe expanding, though, can we extend that to all the other universes, or are we simply in the dark, so to speak?
Well, other physicists love to talk about multiverses and multi-universes, and to me, that's them when they're just playing and having fun. That's not real physics. It's what a physicist does when he lets his imagination loose and writes science fiction. We talk about multiple universes. There's no physics content in that because it's all speculation. And unless a theory has a way of being tested, it's not really what we call a physics theory.
It's just hypothetical?
It's not even hypothetical. It's fantasy.
So all that work of Brian Greene and all those type of physicists who are talking about the multiverses and everything, they're fiction writers maybe?
Oh, it's lovely science fiction.
We're talking again, if you've just joined us, with cosmologist and physicist Richard Muller, and his new book is called The Physics of Time. I'll invite our listeners to join us. His past books include Physics of Future Presidents. As I said to him, we may not be able to understand the present or the past, but who would have thought when he wrote a book about future presidents that Donald Trump would be the president-elect of the United States? I want to get back to free will here, because really, in many respects, what you've put forth here really ties in with our I always love the line by the Yiddish novelist Isaac Bashevis Singer, I asked him very solemnly one time when I was a young professor, do you believe in free will? And he said, I have no choice. You know, but the notion that we're in the now and we have to make these decisions within the now, with the past encroaching upon us. I mean, it's very Buddhist to think I'm just going to be in the moment and I'm going to let the past not affect me necessarily in ways that it could encumber me or create guilt or any of those kinds of things. But to be in the now, again, takes almost a sense of focus and mindfulness, good Buddhist word. It's something that we experience viscerally, but we almost have to also experience in a simultaneous way intellectually, don't we?
Well, some people back in the 1800s, with the enormous advances taking place in physics, pontificated that we have no free will. Arthur Schopenhauer presented a paper to the Finnish Academy of Sciences, in which he said, "Of course, you have free will. You can do anything you want," is what he said. "You can do anything you want, but at any moment, there's only one thing you can want." This was based on an assumption that with the enormous progress of physics, pretty soon we would conclude, and he was already concluding, that if you knew the velocity and position of every particle in the universe, you could predict, using laws of physics, what would come next. So clearly, free will was simply an illusion. That changed in the mid-1900s, when we discovered that quantum physics is not determinist. It is partially. The sun will stay where it is, and the Earth will go around it. There's a lot that is deterministic. But on the small level, you can have two atoms that are absolutely identical. Two atoms of uranium will decay at different times. Now, that doesn't mean that they're exercising free will, but it does mean that physics is not deterministic, that the assumption made by Schopenhauer and by Nietzsche, by Richard Dawkins, by many others, that the universe is deterministic is simply incompatible with what we know about physics. It's wrong.
Joan writes, where does time travel fit into now and the physics of time? Do you think time travel is possible?
Well, when I started writing this book and working on this theory, I was optimistic. There were some serious physics papers about time travel. Kip Thorne had written a paper about—it actually had time travel in the title. I went back and read that paper very carefully, was disappointed to discover that his conclusion at the end is, given the physics we know now, that time travel through a wormhole will not work. But
what was that paper, by the way? Because I remember interviewing him when, I guess he's still at Caltech.
Oh, I think it was the 1980s.
Yeah, but we were talking about it in the early 90s.
It's a famous paper because it was published in the premier physics journal, and it had the word time travel. And people have misinterpreted it ever since. And, of course, Kip Thorne has had a lot of fun, too, because what he said was, well, if we discover a new force of physics that would stabilize wormholes, then we might be able to travel back in time through them. Currently, there is no way to travel back in time. And if my now theory is verified experimentally, then we would unfortunately, sadly, rule it out. That doesn't mean I don't enjoy watching movies about time travel. But if the now theory for the progression of time is correct, then what has happened has happened. What is done and cannot be undone. You have control over the future, some control over the future, because you can exercise non-physics knowledge, physics of love, physics of empathy, physics of the concept of that go beyond physics of love, empathy, justice, fairness. Those things are things you can exercise to direct the way the future of the world is. We can make war or we can make peace. That's up to us. We do have free will. But no, we can't change the past. We will not be able to go back in time.
Although I think Carl Sagan thought that we could go into maybe another dimension through wormholes or something along those lines. But I'm reminded of a science fiction story I read probably as a kid about time travel going back to – guy decided he was going to kill the first mosquito or fly or, you know, we'll get rid of it and change the whole – moves back to the present time, and of course the dinosaurs are ruling the earth, and you know there are all kinds of monsters and so forth and so on. The lesson is a lesson of allegory.
The book I read as a kid is called A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. It was actually written several years before H.G. Wells wrote The Time Machine. And it has people going back in time and changing things, living in the past. It was I really enjoyed that book. It was my first introduction to time travel.
Remember Back to the Future?
I love that movie.
Yeah, it was very entertaining. Are we ever going to unify? I mean, I'm talking about unified field theory, get quantum mechanics together with
gravity.
With gravity, yeah, because that's been, you know, a long dream of physicists going back to Einstein.
I think that's likely to happen. It's not going to be, I mean, I think we're close. String theorists have suggested approaches. Unfortunately, they're not.
Well, you see them as dreamers.
they're dreamers because they're not doing any, they're not suggesting any experimental tests. But the concept that these might be unified is now a real fad in physics. Because it's a fad in physics, and I've made my whole career by looking outside of the fads, I speculate that maybe it will never be unified, that maybe gravity is geometry and that everything else is physics, and we will never have a quantum theory of gravity. I say that, and most physicists groan because they are so convinced that's the case. But I ask them why. It has to do with a hope. The idea that this is what they're fighting for, to unify all of physics. And I remember talking to Steve Weinberg about his electric weak theory, the thing that won him the Nobel Prize, and he complained to me that his theory was ugly. Beauty is not a good guide in developing new physics.
Here's a question from a listener named Keith, and I wrote a book a number of years ago called Spiritual Envy. It was a book about skepticism and agnosticism, and he says, as a Christian, I raised this question. It's a question maybe I shouldn't raise because it's one of those that probably has no answer. But he writes, as a Christian, I can accept the universe was created by the Big Bang, but who created the Big Bang? I'll leave it there.
Well, you know, in my own, I'm a religious person. I pray every day. There, I just prayed now. I took the moment of reminding myself.
And you prayed now, but that now is gone.
but whoever, I mean, the ancient Gnostics believed that there were multiple gods. There were the lesser gods. There was the craftsman, the guy, the contractor, the guy who created the universe. But there was a more important god, the god of empathy, of the knowledge of good and evil. And that's the god that I pay attention to. That's the god that I feel cares about me. Whether God, a God who just wrote down a physics equation and lit the fuse and there's the universe, that's not much interest to me. What I'm interested in is whether there's a God who is in touch with my spirit, who guides me when in love, in fairness, in empathy, in justice, and these other features that to me are the spiritual aspects of reality.
Is that God with you when you pray in the now?
Yeah.
Lucky man. Here's John, who writes, there is a fundamental experience in meditation when one discovers that there is an immediate experience, the sensation of a heartbeat, a breath, a sound, etc. Then this experience moves to concept or an idea of the experience. The mind has a way of ordering all experience into concept. We all tend to live in this world, an infinitesimal moment of experience. Then the mind imprints a complete world. And another listener writes, is free will a given? I've often wondered if our perception of free will is an illusion. Even though physics is not deterministic, it seems to me that free will is just an expression of the same choice that an atom of uranium chooses to decay, to use your example.
Well, I confess I almost bit my tongue when I said a moment ago that free will exists, because I'm not completely convinced of that. My first dramatic experience in this was back in 1978, when my wife and I had our first child, and we decided, really looked at every name you can think of, looked in books, looked in everything, and then we knew we wanted to name her Elizabeth. And this was our great choice of free will. 5 or 6 years later, I was curious. I found a list of favorite names, looked back into 1978. Northern California, the most favorite name of all at that date, at that time, was Elizabeth. Really made me doubt my free will. So no, I don't know. You're right. The fact that physics has phenomena that allow for free will do not mean that I have free will. If I say I have free will, that's more along the lines of a belief or of a sense of reality, but it is certainly not a conclusion. There are ways that you can prove free will doesn't exist, but there are no ways to prove it does exist.
It's also probably hard to figure out how one can observe entropy, even though it's pretty ubiquitous in our universe, at least so it seems. But you say, you come to the kind of almost tentative conclusion that entropy is not the cause, but the effect of time.
Yeah, in fact, we can observe entropy. It's actually,
how do we observe entropy?
It's a tool. The entropy in my cup of coffee is 200 calories per degree Celsius, and you know it's changing as it cools off. Its entropy is decreasing. Entropy is a tool used in engineering, used in all around the world. So we can measure the entropy.
That's why I said it's ubiquitous. But
yeah,
we
can measure the entropy of the sun. Most of the entropy that we detect is actually decreasing. This is one of the odd aspects of entropy that everybody knows, all physicists know, but is not typically...
It's not the lay people's perception of entropy.
No, unfortunately, books that have been written about entropy are highly misleading.
Thomas Pynchon?
Well, they love to give the example of you break a teacup and the entropy increases. And that just shows the inevitability of entropy. Nobody ever mentions that someone made that teacup in the first place.
And had the free will to break it.
And that the clay and the water and the energy that went into it, actually the entropy was enormously reduced. And when you break the teacup, it's not back to where it was, not until you grind it up and spread it out. So in our everyday life is a decrease in entropy. When you're listening to this, if you're learning anything, and I hope maybe you are from this program, then the entropy of your brain is decreasing. Life is when water and air and carbon dioxide come together and form a plant. That's a decrease in entropy. The entropy of the observable universe is actually decreasing.
But when we think of life itself, I mean, aging and decay and all of those things are an entropic process, aren't they?
Well, they do start taking place. Once I'm dead, then certainly. And it's true. As you get older, you feel a little bit dead here and there. But I still think I'm learning. The universe is always having an increase in entropy, but most of that entropy is thrown off like garbage to infinity. It's all in the form of infrared heat. Radiation that goes out into space. The entropy of the observable universe is decreasing, and yet we only get examples of breaking teacups in these other books, not of the manufactured teacups. Civilization is a wonderful example of the decrease in entropy of existence.
You've been listening to a special edition of Forum from our archives. Our guest was physicist Richard Muller. His new book is called Now, the Physics of Time. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum up ahead this holiday season.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.